Welcome to the OMR Podcast International. I'm your host, Scott Peterson, International Content Developer at OMR. I got to tell you, right now, as we're recording this, I'm hungry. Hungry for the future of kitchens. So who better to talk to about that tasty topic than founder and CEO of Circus, Nicholas Bullwinkle. With Circus, Nicholas is taking a very forward-thinking approach to revamping the traditional kitchen setup, trimming off the inefficiencies, 86ing food waste, and adding a fleet of robots. Circus is also deploying AI to craft personalized menus and dishes to users based on user preferences and habits, as well as extenuating circumstances such as time of year and seasonal ingredients. It's a fascinating look into the kitchen and a conversation that will hopefully whet your taste buds for what's to come. All of that and more right now in the OMR Podcast. Buzz. Nicholas, welcome to the OMR Podcast.
Hi.
So I just want to jump kind of right in. It's a very exciting topic, the kitchen of the future. So how did the idea for Circus come about originally?
Yeah, maybe to explain that, maybe a few words on like what our concept is, to understand that a bit. So what we do is we operate so-called micro kitchens, which are in its essence small kitchens, which are really like built for operation efficiency in its core. And mm-hmm. The idea occurred a bit when we really looked into the food delivery market, I think right now, roughly 2 years ago, when we started building on the idea. And what we saw is that most of the food delivery offerings that you have today, mainly on delivery platforms, are really junk food, right? So it's a lot of pizza, there's a lot of burgers, and like medium quality food. And we mm-hmm. really asked ourselves why, because it's not necessarily that people only want to eat junk food. And really start to look into the kitchen processes and really found out that just kitchens, how they're built today, are not really built for efficiency or like any of the volume that they are basically handling. So what they always do is they basically sacrifice quality and food to just maintain their a bit more manual, inefficient operations and make that work. So we said, okay, we want to build a new kitchen concept so that the output for the consumer can be way better, so that we can be more affordable, offer high quality, and have a better standard and a higher efficiency of general operations in kitchens, which are usually quite complex.
Okay. And when did you launch? About a year ago, right?
Yes, roughly, I think May last year.
May of last year. Okay. And how many different iterations have you gone through? Or is this still kind of like the core, the original version?
I think it's basically probably in one iteration in a month, basically. So we've basically changed the whole kitchen concept multiple times and really trying to figure out what the best way is. So then we're trying to build something which is, I don't know, like, you know, really systemized and really standardized for every kind of dish. So what we're also, for example, just one thing to our offering, we're offering everything from, you know, like curries to pasta bowls and so on. So we don't really have this one process that we can use, for example, like a McDonald's that just does burgers or many does burgers. Mm-hmm. So we need to somehow find a way to operate kitchens that it matches different types of, you know, like dishes and culinary mm-hmm. offerings, which always needs quite some iterations to simplify things and see how the workflows are best.
Sure. You mentioned the kitchens, the micro kitchens. How many of these kitchens do you have?
It's a relatively low number, to be honest. We have five up to now. I think mainly, you know, like based on the previous question, mainly because we iterated quite a lot, right? So mm-hmm. what we said is we wanted to focus on product for the first year at least, to really understand how we can make workflows work. How are things working, you know, like for the consumer from the product side? Is the quality even high enough so that we can really maintain it on scale? So all these mm-hmm. things were more in focus than expanding.
All right, so just some additional quick facts kind of for context for the audience. Roughly how many meals do you sell a day?
We're selling basically, we don't really give like detailed numbers, but it's always a few thousand dishes that we're selling a day, and basically sold hundreds of thousands of dishes over the first year.
Okay, what does one cost? Like if I was looking to log into Circus right now and order something, like what is a rough like cost, like ballpark figure?
I think that's one of the most interesting factors, and I think also one of our USPs in the market. We are starting basically for a main dish from roughly €5, which is mainly due to our kitchen like setup and how everything is built, that we have minimal fixed costs compared to regular kitchen setups.
Sure, and also reduce labor costs because, as we'll get into a little bit, kind of like revamping like the whole structure inside the kitchens as far as like employees are concerned, with a very interesting incorporation of AI, which, and also robots, which we'll get to all that stuff later. I don't want to give everything away right now.
Okay.
One last question, kind of for context before we move on. Which cities are you operational in?
We basically started in our headquarters city, Hamburg. We have two locations in Hamburg right now. We have one in Cologne, one in Berlin, and one in Duisburg. It's basically a mix of, you know, like different size of cities, right? So, you know, like doing something in the capital just to see like how things are working in big cities, doing something in a, let's say, tier BC city like Duisburg, so that we can really understand audiences and in different cities and dynamics and different sizes of cities.
Okay, fair enough. Well, before we, you started with Circus, you co-founded Flink, which is an on-demand delivery service specializing in hyperlocal grocery warehouses, which is a pretty very well-known entity, at least in Europe. I just want to kind of ask about your background a little bit, because in your time at Flink, like the whole ultra-fast grocery delivery space had a ton of action in it. There was market consolidation going on. There was competition with all sorts of different players. And generally speaking, just all sorts of upheaval. What do you remember most about your time there?
I think what I remember most, and I think it's also why we basically, a little bit of why we also started Circus, is that really the value of the business is in the operational processes, right? That we really, so I spent like days and nights, especially in the early days, in the warehouses, really trying to understand how can we really be fast, how we can show quality. I mean, right now it's cooking dishes. Back then it was basically packing a bag of groceries, but it's really similar in its core process. And that this was really what kept, I think, all of us up at night, really figuring out how we can run these operations on scale so they're not basically breaking and everything goes crazy after days. And I think to understand that this is really where the value in the business is, I mean, you know, like there's definitely a few other factors, but really owning and controlling operations properly was key always.
And just like the perfection of this execution in the margins type of thing.
Yeah,
exactly. And how many, like what exactly was your role there? Because I mean, you were co-founder and also I believe the title was, at least according to LinkedIn, was director of experience.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a broad title. So basically from to right. So I've been mainly involved on the early days, the first year, so it was really building up processes, building up the software products for the warehouses to understand how we can better there from the interfaces to also the consumer app and like this overall operational flow more from a product side and so let's say a tech side to like build different microservices.
Okay. So in retrospect, I mean, you were there for around 8 months, if I'm not mistaken, a little bit, give or take. What would you say, like, in retrospect, was your biggest failure, your biggest learning from your time there that you've been able to apply to Circus?
I think it's probably also like building the structures in your teams. I mean, back then, right, it was one of the fastest growing companies in Europe. And I think we've been expanding like crazy to, you know, like building teams, hiring basically, you know, like also from operation point, hundreds of people a day at some point, which was definitely nothing I've experienced before. I think most of the team members haven't either. So that was definitely one of the biggest the big things that we need to do. And also I think one of the biggest things, but for example, I learned quite a lot of how to build teams and how to structure teams on a rapid pace, you know, like which I think was also at that point, definitely right now looking back, where we had quite some, or I had quite some things that I'm doing differently today, how we're basically structuring teams and setting everything up.
Okay. So why did you step away? Because, I mean, that seemed like a very interesting space. It was like burgeoning. There was a lot of upheaval, like I'd mentioned. It was Wild West, a lot of opportunity, potential. And you were, quote unquote, only there for 8 months. And then you walked away to start a new venture.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is, I mean, there's different factors, right? So the one thing is like, so the base of Flink is another company, which is called Pickery, which I founded before. So there was also like roughly a year involved in that. So it's 8 months at Flink, but you know, like if you add basically the merger to that, it's definitely a much longer time.
Sure.
And like giving the Wild West, as you said, it felt like 5 years or 6 years, and given the pace that we were operating at. So I think at that point, so when I left, I think we were roughly like 10 to 15,000 employees. So you know, like quite a massive company. Mm-hmm. So it was really more the moment to say like, okay, I'm maybe more looking for something which is a bit less Wild Wild West and where we can also disrupt on a similar level, mm-hmm. but in a similar industry. And I think also the idea from Circus, right, is very close to the idea of Flink. So we were also always like discussing back then, okay, could we do the same thing to food, to kitchens? What are the potential verticals, right? I mean, mm-hmm. pharmacy popped up, food popped up. So sure. There was always the idea of it. And basically that's where I said, okay, I'm ready for a new challenge and a different market, and jumped off there to start Circus.
All right. Well, then where exactly or when exactly did the idea for Circus come about? Like, was there like a moment where, like you said, you were exploring these verticals and stuff where you're like, okay, this is why we have to focus on reinventing kitchens?
I think the idea was always there. And I think the idea is not necessarily completely new of like operating ghost kitchens, right? So mm-hmm. We were looking into this quite early, and also like before Flink, it was an existing market of ghost kitchens. I think mm-hmm. the approach that we did differently is like we didn't focus too much on the real estate game or virtual brands. We were really trying to see basically from the angle that I was coming from of like knowing like, okay, the operational process matter, to look into a kitchen and say like, okay, this is where we need to start. This is where we need to improve, and all the rest will follow, right? So better economics will follow, better offering, better quality for the consumer will follow. I think the idea really grew over time, right? So mm-hmm. basically went out, said like, okay, we want to do something in ghost kitchen, but figured out over time really where the big issues are and where the challenges are that we need to tackle.
It seems like a very ambitious goal or sector, space, to say the least, because gastronomy and the restaurant business is notoriously competitive. You have restaurants and kitchens and all these things just like kind of popping up and then going away relatively quickly. So like, why did you identify that as an attractive business opportunity, and how are you able to communicate that to like some of your financial backers?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a really... It's a massive industry, right, with a bunch of players, but that doesn't necessarily make the industry efficient or, you know, like really future-proof, let's say. Mm-hmm. So we saw that, you know, like a bunch of players and like small restaurants as well as bigger food chains are really lacking behind massively when it comes to automation, when it comes to AI anyways, mm-hmm. when it comes to digital products in the first place. So that's where we said, okay, there is a massive opportunity. And I think at that point it was good that the industry is so massive because, you know, like there's... You don't need to create a demand, right? So there is a really massive existing demand of consumers who want to order food. And we just need to get better at the output that we can provide to the consumer.
Sure, and people want to eat every day.
Yeah, exactly. So I think for our financial backers, it was more like, okay, understanding where you want to start. I think what we always did is we did tours of our first kitchens to show what we're doing differently, because not mm-hmm. always that easy to explain that our kitchens are so different, basically. And we did that and we showed how we are cooking, how we're basically rethinking the entire process. And I think mm-hmm. we got their interest from that, and they got the vision what we want to build.
All right. Well, let's maybe for people that I spent over a decade working in kitchens. I'm a trained chef and all this stuff, so I kind of know what's going on a little bit in the kitchen. But maybe just like provide a little bit of context, kind of look under the hood. Like, what are like some of the traditional economies of restaurants that you were trying to improve upon, whether it's, you know, ordering process, labor costs, things like that, where you're trying, where you're hoping that Circus is going to be a more efficient model moving forward?
I think basically what we can start from is the base. It's like the real estate and the fixed cost block on just the location that you are operating in and that you set up before you even start a restaurant and, you know, like start mm-hmm. a kitchen, which normally is tied to, you know, like a guest room, you know, like a nice location where you need the foot traffic that you're relying on. And, you know, like there's a whole infrastructure behind, and the fixed costs are relatively high. Mm-hmm. With a kind of micro kitchen model, what we're more aiming towards, like, you know, like we're more taking the, let's say, the small side street. We don't need a guest room. We have a much smaller space. We have, by that way, lower requirements when it comes to overall, you know, like setting up of the kitchen. Mm-hmm. So that's that makes things a bit easier for us. And from operational perspective, I think when you look, as mentioned, when you look into the kitchen, so like waste is a massive topic. How you structure the inventory and really even know what is going on in the kitchen is not always a set standard. And the whole overall training of the people, which are, to be honest, often are not, especially in bigger restaurant chains, are not trained chefs. It's just like labor that needs to be trained for that purpose, because there is a massive labor shortage in that industry. So these are all the different challenges that we are tackling with different tech products that we are basically building, different microservices.
All right. When you are kind of training some of your human labor, the line cooks, as it were, like how long does it take to get somebody who's maybe like never actually worked in a kitchen, like able to wield a knife without hurting themselves? Because like I said, like I spend a lot of time in the kitchens and I like to cook and all these things. But occasionally, if I'm not paying attention, I will slice off part of my finger and that hurts. And if you're not used to that or ready for that, like that can be very disheartening and a source of fear for a lot of people and make them not want to come back. So like just generally speaking, like how long does it take you to like kind of like train your workforce?
Yeah. So we need a day, a good day, and then everybody's ready. But maybe to give you some context on that, how that works is, I think the first thing on the knives, I think we have a knifeless kitchen, so we don't have any cutting boards or knives in the kitchen, not a single one, which definitely helps quite a lot in preventing these things, specifically when we're talking about untrained labor. So what we basically did from the start is we have a really strong culinary and sourcing team that is sourcing all the ingredients, and we have a bunch of partners that we're basically like sourcing all the ingredients from, but they're always basically pre-cut or ready-made for us. So like, for example, let's say the tomato comes cut in half so that we can directly use it. So it's easier to manage our inventory. We not only have less waste, we don't have all these different pre-production steps in the kitchen. So the kitchen workflows are way simpler. The second thing on like why it's so fast to train everybody is because we have the interfaces for the chefs. So you're basically, you can think about a bit like going into a workstation, like a Vapiano kind of station, right? Where you have everything around you. So all you do is like turn around your own axis and can reach everything that you need to work. And before, like on the height of your eyes, basically there's a tablet where you can follow every step, right? So you see, okay, there's a new dish order coming in. That's the step. These are the ingredients, the exact spoon size that I need for that. These are the steps that I need to fulfill to do that. Mm-hmm. So when I right now would put you on one of our stations, you would basically, I think you would be able to cook everything immediately. The only thing is you would probably be a bit slower, right? So just because you need to understand the interface first and you know, like follow the steps that you've never seen before. But in general, you could do the entire process.
Okay, so it's similar to, at least to a certain extent, to using the Thermomix, the Bimby thing, like where you have this kind of like set menu, or not, you have a set of instructions that you follow, and it's hard to make a huge mistake so that nothing can go wrong, or little can go wrong.
Exactly.
So one of the most fascinating things about Circus, at least in my view, is how y'all are using automation and kind of digitization to like improve some of these operational challenges. And we touched on it a little bit, like how like you're basically getting rid of the knives, you're getting rid of some of these like excessive or areas where an untrained workforce may be inefficient in their processes. So I'm just like curious, like generally speaking, like how in like what other areas are like automation and AI and digitization kind of like helping to streamline the entire process?
Yeah. So maybe a bit on the background, like how are we thinking about kitchens in general? I think what we always think about is like three core pillars, how a kitchen works and what we need to basically kind of digitalize. So one thing is efficiency. I think a bit what we just talked about, right? Inventory management, having a good overview and control of the kitchen. I think the second thing is the creativity, right? So you need to come up with nice recipes, need to understand your what you're doing and that everything matches. That's basically where the AI part is coming in. And the third part, which is kind of the craft of building the dish, this is really where automation comes in a bit more. And so that kind of fulfills the whole kitchen operational process. Talking a bit on the AI part, what we realized really early on is that we need to create a model where we not only have a huge or a massive assortment of dishes and just variation of dishes, we also need to become a bit more tailored and personalized to the end consumer. So, you know, like if we just start to offer a million of dishes, that wouldn't necessarily become a better offering for the consumer. Mm-hmm. It just would be super confusing. So we started really early on to generate dishes via AI, mm-hmm. from the recipe to every work step to the portioning to also the content. So right now, even today, as a side note, all the dish pictures in our app that you see are fully generated by AI. So we are not shooting a single dish picture. Okay. All of these dishes that are there have basically never existed. And sometimes we're just launching them within seconds, see if they get any kind of traction. If not, we're just kicking them out again. So we can be much, much faster about generating and building a culinary offering. And where we want to go with this is, because I also mentioned the million of offerings, is that we can become way, way more personalized towards the end consumer, mm-hmm. and basically fill a data set or kind of a culinary intelligence, so to say, with input from the consumer, what they've liked, what they don't like, what are their meal preferences. I don't know, even adding weather data if you want to see, mm-hmm. Is it a sunny day, a rainy day? So we can basically build way better dishes for you and show you the perfect dish so that every dish that you see on our app feels like your new favorite dish because you love everything else.
Okay, but so you're trying to incorporate other external factors like weather and things to kind of be an indicator as far as what somebody's preference might be, and then hope to, in the precise moment, suggest something that speaks to their preferences personally.
Yeah, I mean, weather is one of the smaller examples, right? Starting mainly with the customer input, what they've ordered before, what are the allergies and all of these kind of things.
Sure.
And then basically adding external data. And it's not only recommending the dish, it's generating the dish on spot. So it's not that we're basically just saying we have 100 dishes and right now we basically give you the one that is closest to what we think. We mm-hmm. can literally generate the entire dish on spot and, change grams, change the sauce. So there might be a dish that I've never been before that we just generated for you on spot.
Okay. No, I was just thinking so if you're in the middle of the summer and it's 35 degrees, which for my American friends is around 100 degrees, you suggest to them a super heavy stew, that's probably not going to have as many takers as something a lighter salad or whatever, one example. But okay. So once you have these data sets in place, then I can totally understand and see how you'd be able to personalize some of these recommendations and these recipes. But how does that work at first? Is it just kind of shooting fish in a barrel and you see what sticks? Or I imagine there's some type of initial process infrastructure set up so that you can start generating the information, collecting the information that you need, right?
Yeah, 100%. So I think that's also what we started with when we initially launched. So we launched with, around 60 dishes, then built this up to a few hundred dishes that we had live. And right now, basically, we're down to decreasing it again and getting better. So what we really, it's a bit to figure out just by shooting and seeing what sticks.
Yeah.
We started with a bunch of things from pizza to burgers. We did everything just to see what is really working and not mm-hmm. only what sells in the first place, but also which dishes are creating retention, right? So everybody buys a pizza on a new delivery service. That's kind of easy to sell, but it's not necessarily easy to generate a retaining customer just because you're selling a pizza, because nearly everybody has a favorite pizza spot where you would always get your pizza, right? Just as an example. But we, for example, figured out one of our best sellers till today is a cheese spätzle, a very German dish, mm-hmm. which also sold really nicely during summer and 35 degrees, which I think no one of us would have ever expected that people would buy that. It's really trying to figure out how customers behave and understanding better how their taste patterns are in a way, mm-hmm. So we can get better. And I think right now we're at a certain stage where we can do that for the overall menu in a way better way than when we started. We're not at a point yet where we can do this specifically to every consumer at every given time, but mm-hmm. we're basically getting into this with weekly menus and trying to understand that way better and better over time.
All right. Well, it's certainly fascinating. And I think it's fair to see that fair to say that you definitely view Circus as a food tech company. And, aside from the obvious of where you are incorporating tech into the kitchen, using it to streamline a lot of the inefficiencies, is it at all detrimental to frame, to like have a business or like where the kitchen is, has a focus, has a tech focus? Because generally speaking, the macro trend in food and dieting and all this stuff is trying to get back to the roots, and which is like get away from tech and get away from things like that, and, you know, whole foods and all these things. Is that challenging at all for you to overcome when it comes to reaching new customers or expanding your customer base?
I think it's kind of the opposite. Just because, for example, one of our USPs that I think I mentioned a bit in the start is that we really have, you know, like a very fair price for all the dishes, and you know, like not cheap, but you know, like you can really start eating at our at Circus from roughly €5. Mm-hmm. And a lot of customers would, you know, like question that and say like, okay, how is that possible? That can't be good food, right? But it can if you really enable technology to, you know, like, kill all the inefficiencies, to have a, you know, like more structured and streamlined kitchen process, so you mm-hmm. can still buy food at a high quality and produce it or assemble it on a way easier process. And I think by always putting in the tech factor, it gets way better. Like it's way more understandable for customers how that's even possible.
All right. But so then just to like, so I can like completely wrap my head around like maybe of the whole process, maybe you like take me through the journey of a single meal, like, and how many people, human beings are involved, how, like, which areas does like kind of like the automation kick in? I mean, you talked about like how like the cooks will be, you know, following a tablet, the instructions on the tablet as they come in, but like that kind of overlooks like the sourcing that is going on. You'd mentioned the culinary source team, I think is what they're called. Mm-hmm. So like, and then we also have like the delivery models and the interaction with customers, which I assume could possibly be done with bots. But yeah, so just like kind of like maybe just a quick overview of like the journey of a single menu, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe starting, you know, from, let's say, the sourcing part and also the AI part, right? So that's basically where the magic happens on a culinary side. Mm-hmm. So what we do start with is we are not starting with building the dish. We're always starting with sourcing the ingredients, which is kind of, for a regular kitchen, also always kind of reverse, because normally you create the dish first and then you see where you can buy the ingredients. Mm-hmm. What we're doing, what the sourcing team does is we've basically generated a stack of ingredients of, which is roughly 60, 70 at the moment. You know, like depends a bit on season and mm-hmm. complexity of general menu. And we really started with sourcing every single ingredient, and so to have the maximum flexibility, right? So I tried over 20 tomatoes to say like, okay, that's the perfect tomato, and everybody in the team agreed, okay, this is mm-hmm. a good cherry tomato, that it doesn't has too much water, and it's, you know, like it doesn't crush in the box, and so it works for, I don't know, like a bowl, a pizza if you want, a curry. So we mm-hmm. have one ingredient with the maximum flexibility. And then we take all these kind of flexible ingredients, generate a dish, offer it to the customer from the Circus app. So you can mm-hmm. basically, as a customer, just go to the app, see a bunch of dishes, which are, you know, like more or less personalized to your preferences. As mentioned, working on that to get that, make that better. Mm-hmm. And you order via our own app, so it's not really too much platform dependent, or like a Lieferando or Vault or so on. We work with them, sure. but it's a smaller fraction. The dish lands in the kitchen, gets basically prepared by the chef. I think as mentioned, but via the tablet, and gets packed. So it's only touched by one chef, right? So the dish process is really simple. There's not a lot of people involved in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Then we always have one person to basically pick and pack the entire order, make sure all the dishes are right. So we have a bunch of quality measures in this, so that, you know, like every dish gets scanned, gets checked, so that we can make sure that's the right dish going to the right bag. And then it gets handed over, sometimes to our own riders, sometimes to external parties, right? So we're running with a mix, just because we started with our own riders, not necessarily because it's the easiest thing to do, mm-hmm. but mainly because we wanted to own the consumer in the start. And I believe that's one of the most important things, to really understand the consumer. Also sometimes, like, in the start, at their doorstep, to get the feedback, to have your own application where you can run the whole operations, the last mile, so you can really understand your entire operations. And then right now, over time, we're basically building up more and more different channels, like pickup. We're integrating with Uber Direct, so we can utilize an Uber fleet. So different mm-hmm. things, how we can just build alternative channels without losing the the direct relation to our consumers.
Fair enough. And what about like your customer acquisition channels? Like what are kind of like some of the growth strategies in place? Like where are you reaching new customers?
Yeah, it's actually a funny thing because it's super simple and because it's always hyper local, right? So technically our marketing team needs to act like we just own a single restaurant. So we always need to understand the area because it doesn't make sense to, I don't know, like do a TV spot on a national level and you just have, sure. I don't know, like one area in the city life. So what we do is a lot of really hyper-local marketing. So for example, we go with door hangers a lot, which is the best performing marketing channel so far and has always been. And you like you know, from a hotel door, basically.
Sure.
And we just say like, hey, we invite you for a free meal. And when you come home, that's what hangs at your doorstep. So you know, like it's a really easy way to integrate with a customer on a hyper-local level. Mm-hmm. And it makes us also feel more like, okay, we are close to you. We are in a restaurant nearby, which we in essence are. Mm-hmm. And then obviously on top, there's a bunch of base channels, let's say from out of home to you know, like working and partnering with different creators to performance marketing. But these hyper local channels have always worked best. And I think also created the best relation to the brand.
Okay. But you said you also work with some influencers, some like online creators and whatnot.
Yes, from time to time, not necessarily on you know, like on a dish level or on a creation on a creator level, just you know, mm-hmm. like to advertise and show a product. We've done a bunch of different things, but I would say that's not too much of innovation on that side. It's more a base. I think it is a base channel for every marketing stack.
Fair enough, but digital marketing not so much. It's just mostly like the traditional, like you hand out flyers, you hang them on the door handles, you drop them in their mailboxes. That is the primary growth channel.
I mean, it just works. It works best for us, right? So, like, sure. When you really want to scale on a hyper local level and want to make sure that that everybody in the area knows you, that's mm-hmm. always the best part. I mean, that's for example where creators come in, and you can always say, like, okay, who's in this area the most known creator? Which is not always the biggest creator. Like, I think it's the opposite, right? You need to find the really local. The local known people, which are always micro influencers and like always people that are, I don't know, like maybe the most known athlete from the gym in that area, or like these kind of small stuff. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to figure out. So like the heroes of your neighborhood, basically, rather than the biggest influencers on the platforms.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, I mean, like we'd said earlier, like it's Circus has been around for just over a year. And in that time, about 18 million euros has been raised in funding. And there's recently almost five and a half million, I think, that you raised with a funding round that was led by Black Mars Capital and 2BX. So just out of curiosity, like moving forward, where are you planning to allocate that newly acquired capital? Is it going to be like primarily for growth or fine-tuning the operations, a little bit of both?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. So what we want to focus on and continue to focus on is really building an amazing product, just because like what we believe in that is like early expansion doesn't necessarily solve all your pains. It more creates some. If you're like sure. really haven't figured out the details of your operations, it will just crash at some point. So we really focus on building the product. I think there's also where automation and a recent acquisition comes in. I think that's basically where we spend some money of the new capital. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we just acquired the basically leading culinary robotics company in Europe mm-hmm. called Aidme. And they basically had a strong focus on the B2B part, right? So offering their robotic units in canteens, hotels, and so on. Mm-hmm. And we basically acquired them to really like buy a very, very strong team of knowledge in operations and automation, which matches nicely to you know, like our AI and tech components that we already have. And we can build on top of that, and we really focus on building the product and the operations from there.
Okay, well, so just curiosity, like what role are these robots going to be performing in the kitchen?
So the robots will take over the entire cooking process, basically. So I think you mentioned a few times back the Thermomix example, kind of like the robotics tells are kind of a massive Thermomix, so to say. Mm-hmm. And what we have today is like we have different setups of where ingredients are stored. We still have an oven and like and things, and there's always a bunch of manual steps that mm-hmm. need to be trained and that are quite complex. So what we will do is we're going to basically replace that entire setup of a station and just place a robotics unit, which is way, way easier to handle from a training perspective, obviously from a quality control perspective, so mm-hmm. that the human component in that model shifts a bit away from training and cooking in a way to really fulfillment, packing, handover, last mile, and so on.
Okay. I'd like to put a bow on the funding aspect. Do you have any plans for international expansion or further expansion within Germany? Because you said you're really focusing on the product right now. But I mean, I would imagine over time, like you obviously want to scale it up. And internationally could be interesting, or are you just completely focused on Germany at the moment?
I think we're not necessarily focused on Germany. I mean, that's kind of like our core and where we come from, and we still see a lot of opportunity within the market. Also, like as mentioned a bit, like BC cities are most of the time not tackled from bigger players at all. So the second part on this is like when you go to another country, you definitely need to rethink the culinary offering quite a bit, right? So what works in Germany doesn't necessarily work in another country. So that's where it makes sense to scale from Germany to other countries.
But wouldn't the AI portion of that, like we have the data sets where like the customers are kind of influencing that, kind of mitigate that a little bit?
It's more the ingredient part, right? So it's just because we need to source different ingredients and make sure like, okay, that necessarily our ingredients don't necessarily work just from a supply side and also from a taste side. When we go to France, let's say. But coming back to your question on like Europe or international, yes, we want to do that. And we also want to do this as soon as possible once we feel ready to scale with the product. We're in the process of also building and launching our franchise concept. So, I mean, you probably know, like launching kitchens is quite capital intensive. And what we did in the start is like we said, okay, we will launch a handful of kitchens, operate them ourselves, make sure we get them to a profitable level to really have proof that the concept works and that we understood the operations. And from there, basically hand over to franchisees and scale it from there. And this is basically where, right, the world is our market, and we can really see like where do we have interest and how can we scale in different countries. But since Germany is one of the heaviest regulated market when it comes to food hygiene, like and how we build our entire concept, every other country that we would expand into, it just gets easier just from a like setting up from a setup of the kitchen.
All right, fair enough. And how far along are you in the franchising like process? Because that is absolutely like the kind of gold standard when it comes to like having any type of chain in the restaurant industry.
I think like from technically, right, from a legal side and like the general setup, we would be ready, let's say within weeks. It's more the part of the robot, which like just takes time. So we want to, you know, still focus a bit on the product, make sure that we can as fast as possible also integrate the robotic part into the kitchen model, which like also for franchisees creates a massive new opportunity. I think we would be the first food chain offering a fully automated cooking process. And I think as a franchisee, it's always the hardest thing to find the matching labor, you know, like which you need to train and like which is always not easy to maintain necessarily. I think we are running into a good demand from franchise side from a franchisee side over there.
All right. Well, Nicholas Bolwiger, I don't have anything else to add. This has been a fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Buzz. That's it. That's our show, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone in between and beyond. I want to thank Nicholas for taking the time to talk to me today about the future of kitchens, and big thanks to all of you for listening. If you liked what you heard, tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe. Until we talk again, swim with a buddy.